The next segment, the topic of the next segment is mental capacity in the old and infirm. An analysis of how Halacha views mental capacity and the effect of a will executed when the testator had diminished capabilities or when a beneficiary may have had undue influence. And the person presenting is the dean of the Business Halacha Institute and the Rav of the shul downstairs. Rav Chaim Cohen is also dying in Kilas Hadas Yishurim. Introducing the topic and introducing, moderating the next topic is Mr. Hillel Weiss of Greenwald Weiss, who have offices located in Brooklyn and Lakewood and focus on estate planning and estate related topics. I just wanted one last reminder before you leave today. Please hand in your sign-in and sign-out sheets and evaluations. Thank you.
Good afternoon. First of all, thank you to Business Halacha Institute and Rabbi Ari Marburger and Chaim Cohn for inviting us here and allowing us to be part of this very important event. The topic of this segment is mental issues in the old and infirm. More specifically, challenges to testamentary bequests of individuals with diminished capacity. This is an increasingly frequent topic in today's world with the growing older population and with people living longer. So I'm going to just present a case study just to provide some context to Reb Chaim's halakhic discussion and a very brief overview of the legal background to this issue. Let us introduce Mr. Friedman, who's 86 years old. And he was 68, now he's 86 years old, and he recently lost his wife in 2010. In 2012, he moved in, realizing he can't manage on his own, he moved in with his daughter and son-in-law, the Kleins, who are taking good care of him. He has four other children. In the year 2000, he, together with his late wife, executed wills, leaving everything to each other, and then at second death, everything equal to their children. As the time is going on, in the last couple of years, Mr. Friedman is increasingly realizing that his son-in-law and daughter are starting to resent this situation where they're the only children taking care of him. And on more than one occasion, his son-in-law, Mr. Klein, has mentioned to him that maybe he should be redoing his will to give a bigger portion or the complete estate, to leave the complete estate to the clients. Mr. Friedman recognizes the dilemma. On the one hand, he doesn't want to differentiate between his children. He wants to leave everything equal. But on the other hand, he does understand that the clients, by taking care of him, should maybe be getting a little more than the other children. One day, Mr. Friedman comes home after Shacharis, comes home to the house and sees a couple of people sitting around the table, his daughter and son-in-law with another couple other people. His son-in-law introduces, "Father, this is the lawyer, and these are two witnesses. You came just in time to sign your new will." He asks, what's in this will? The lawyer says, "This will is leaving everything to the clients." So he quickly surveys the situation, understands that he cannot manage on his own. He needs his daughter and son-in-law's help. Doesn't like the tactics they're using, but he signs the will. Now, let us present a little bit of a variation to the facts. In the last couple of years, Mr. Friedman is starting to become very forgetful. He doesn't recognize his grandchildren anymore. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to carry on an intelligent conversation with him. When he arrived at the will signing ceremony, the attorney asked him, "Do you know who your children are?" With some parting, after some parting by his daughter, he was able to list his children. He asked him, "Do you understand that this will is giving everything to your daughter?" He said he understood that. And then he asked him, "Do you know what your assets are, what you own?" And he more or less explained more or less understood and knew what his assets were. So that's our facts. Now, just very briefly, how a court would look at this. So there's two issues here. There's the issue of testamentary capacity, which means, did the testator have the requisite capacity to execute a will? And the New York courts generally look at three factors. Did the testator know who the objects of his or her bounty were? Meaning, who would take, if there wouldn't be a will, who would be the ones to inherit the testator? Meaning his family members. The second thing is, did the testator understand what the contents of the will was that changed whatever the intestacy rules are? And third, did he have a general understanding of his assets? The burden of proving these three factors is on the proponent of the will, the person bringing forth the will. But generally, it's a very low threshold. You only have to show, a basic understanding of what your assets are, a basic understanding of who your children are, and, knowing what the terms of the will are. The second issue is the legal issue of undue influence, meaning that was there a party that influenced the testator's son, execution of the will influenced to the point where it took away his or her free will and her judgment. That's the high threshold, which this burden of proof is generally on the objecting to the will. Did the testator have free will when they decided how to distribute the assets? So in our case, most likely on the first issue of testamentary capacity, in the second variation of facts, the court would find most likely that the testator did have testamentary capacity. They did understand who their children were, who his children are, and what the will is purporting to do, how it's changing the intestacy distribution, and he understood in a general sense what his assets are. In the undue influence question, certainly in our first variation where the testator didn't have any diminishment of capacity, the court would generally find that he definitely was not undue influenced. He made his own free choice, and it was with his free will. In the case in our second variation where he has diminished capacity, there it's again up to debate whether a court will find that the combination of the diminished capacity of the testator with the undue influence by his daughter and son-in-law, whether that takes away his free will and whether there's a valid challenge. Just to conclude with one thing, the way to avoid such issues by parties is by having open communication by children and discussing, who will be the one to take care of a loved one and how they will be compensated for it. So I will let Sarah Klein. discuss the halachic issues.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weiss, for your beautiful presentation. I hope that my class is not of undue influence. I hope so. The truth of the matter is that this subject always fascinated me for a simple reason. As my good friends know, my major interest in Choshen Mishpat is not even so much the active application of it, which I have to do by virtue of my job. It's even more the jurisprudence aspect of it. And I do feel that this subject here that we're discussing is a perfect example for comparative law of the difference how halacha or common law would look at the case, the criteria, and so forth. As it was correctly mentioned, the issues that we have that are to be discussed here are in principle two or maybe three. Mental capacity. Okay. Is the mental capacity of the person up to par that he is able to have dealings of commercial nature and so on and so forth? So you see, there's a concept in halacha which is called a shote. A shote. Now, a shote is not an idiot. An idiot is a patsy. Today, what we understand, generally speaking, an idiot is a patsy. Patsy means a person with limited mental capacity. That's a patsy. A person who either by birth or because of some medical condition is not in the capacity of understanding matters coherently and so on and so forth, he's a patsy. There is something else called a shoyter. A shoyter is a person who has a kind of irrational behavior sometimes, most of the times, or does things that we see clearly that he is not thinking in the way that commonly people think. There's a whole Gemara in Chagiga, Ki Yodua, the beginning of Chagiga, that Gemara over there discusses simonim of a shoyter, different indications that a person is a shoyter. And there are the Machlekes Rishonim, there are different arguments in the Rishonim which are not really so relevant for our discussion. What exactly is it all about here, that we're talking about this kind of person is not an idiot. A person who is called, halachically speaking, a shoyter. Shoyter because he's not doing the regular thing, like now those who learn Dafayomi learning Sota, like the Sin and the Shin is interchangeable in this case. So it is also somebody, a lady, that is not doing the regular. She's irregular. She's not doing the correct thing, the right thing. Similarly here, on a mental level, this person, for example, the classic example given in the Gemara is the person who sleeps over in a cemetery. Right? Okay. So he sleeps on a cemetery. Maybe he likes it. Who knows what, right? Maybe he speaks to some spirits over there. Who knows? But we understand that in other areas, he might be completely normal. He walks into his law office in the morning. I'm sorry. Nothing. No. No pun intended. And behaves like normal. But at night, he goes to the cemetery to sleep over there. So it's irregular, abnormal. And we're not talking about this kind of person. In terms of our discussion, really what is relevant is more the situation of a patsy. Here, I would say, it's quite arbitrary. Meaning, what arbitrary means that what people commonly would say, maybe a physician would say the person is not really in his real capacity, was not able to have his independent way of thinking and so on and so forth because of this medical condition or whatever, because he's retarded to begin with. And then he would be considered a patsy. It is also true that many poskim hold to begin with, even in a situation of a shoter, which halachically would not be a person to fit to give a get or something of this sort, but we're talking about commercial dealings, still his commercial dealings might be fit and right and correct. So therefore, this is not so much a discussion that we have today, because, as I say, patsy is a patsy, you know, a person who is retarded. If it's dementia or something else, I don't care so much about it. So therefore, this case that was mentioned earlier, for Mr. Friedman, right? Friedman is a fine line. Okay, so then Mr. Friedman, if La'aleinu La'aleichem got to a point where he's not able to speak coherently, to understand things coherently, and so on and so forth, then yes, he might have already reached the level of a patsy. We'll have to have evidence to that, and then If he signs on any kind of document of commercial nature, including the will, it would not be considered valid. That's fine. The real issue that we have to discuss are the two other issues, which is called in legal language undue influence, and the other one is oinus. Oinus means a person being forced under conditions of force, having done something. And here, this is exactly where we arrive at the point where the halachic thinking, logic, is completely different than we have it in common law. Regardless of the threshold that you mentioned earlier, that would be considered in court to be a valid argument to say that undue influence existed or didn't exist, halakhically speaking, the concept of undue influence altogether doesn't exist. Furthermore, when we would say that in common law, if a person was threatened and therefore was compelled to give up ownership, which is the concept of oinus, halacha would look at it completely different than in common law. And I will explain it to you, and probably many of you, those who are learned and know the halacha very well, that shouldn't be no surprise for them. Although, I must say, I was surprised by some people when I discussed with them, say, is this really true? It seems to be, it's still somewhat a novel idea if people relate it to real life. Okay. So let me start with the concept of oinus. The concept of a person being forced to do anything. So we have everybody knows, oinus rachmanei patri. Meaning if a person is in a situation where he was forced to do something, so then he will not be liable for whatever he did. This is true when you're talking ben odom lamokri. Meaning if you're talking a person having transgressed some kind of sin, he has done something which halakhically speaking he shouldn't do because of the religious nature of it, so then, certainly, oinus rachmanei patri, whatever there should be. The Torah said, you will not be punished for that. The Torah patri, the Torah said that you will not be in any way felt liable for this. Very nice, that's true. But, just the opposite might be true when you're talking about commercial situations. And this goes as follows. There's a principle in any commercial deal, as long as the person received counter value for what he gave up, the deal is a deal. What's the counter value? Okay, so counter value is, if, like, say for argument's sake, I'm getting money, and I was threatened that, you know, you better give it to me, because otherwise who knows what, and I don't see what who knows what is. So, okay, fine. Willing to give it. Given that the money was given to the person, so we have the famous principles of the Gemara. The Gemara says, Talui Bizovin, forced to sell, Zvini Zvini. The sale is valid, given that he was compensated with the true value of this deal. Okay, so we have already one situation. I'm not so sure that this will be the case in common law. I'm not a lawyer, but I would presume that there could be a very good case argued in front of courts to say the person was forced to sell, he never wanted to sell, so although he said at the end, I want to do it, it was just because he had no choice, but he should start now arguing and so forth. He gave it up under duress, and therefore we should not consider that as a valid argument. But let me go further. We have somebody who is threatened that his life is threatened. Life is in danger. He tells the potential murderer, you know what, I give you all my assets. Give me all my assets, just save my life. And you know the murderer is here for serious, for real. And he says, I'm willing to give all I own, just save my life. What's the law in this case? Well, I guess, in common law, we would say that probably the murderer, the potential murderer at least, right, will have no right to hold on to the assets. Halakhically speaking, no question, he owns it. That's the famous case of Tricricon. When the times of the Romans, when the Romans came in and started to threaten people's life, people were willing to give up all they had just to save their lives. The counter value for my life certainly is worth all my assets. Everything he possesses we're willing to give up in order to save his life. So here we have a counter value. Why would it be that in such a situation, when you're talking about common law, presumably, and I think you will not argue with me, it would be a very strong argument that courts would invalidate this whole deal. Whereas, in halacha, we are going to say the opposite. The rent is very simple. And please remember that, and probably if you heard once of my shiurim, I always repeat it, that I think it's an important message, in my opinion. Chosh Mishpat is not a moral code, it's a legal code. It's a legal code that functions with a particular mechanism. And the mechanism is simply, like you have it in nature, the same thing, the same story. If something, if I trigger a particular reaction, it's going to happen. And the reaction is as follows. If I buy something, you have to give counter value, regardless of the surrounding factors. This regards completely the surrounding factors. The fact that the person who's threatened is a murderer, and therefore I'm willing to give up all I possess, does not take away from the simple fact that there was here an exchange of values. I got my life and he got my assets. People might begin to argue and say, well, you got more than I got. You got your life. I only got assets. The moral argument here is completely disregarded. Choshen Mishpat is not a reflection of moral values. Choshen Mishpat is a reflection of legal standards, of a legal mechanism. It doesn't mean that therefore we should not take any moral argument into consideration. I'm not saying that at all. And in fact, if you come to Beis Din, and Beis Din is going to stand up people of Rishonim Lishon Sadin, they should do more than what the law says to do and obligates to do, and certainly we are going to do that. Koifin of Rishonim Lishon Sadin, we are going to enforce him on that, that's fine. But I'm talking about the system as such. And therefore, as far as is concerned, the argument of duress is a very difficult argument, usually. Very difficult argument. In particular, let's talk about this case of Mr. Friedman. Mr. Friedman, he's in a situation here where he wants to have the rest of his life being cared for. He wants to be cared for. And he understands that, yes, it's not a very, how should I say, sympathetic situation. He would have hoped that his daughter and his son-in-law would use different ways of behavior, okay? Probably he didn't learn yeshiva, maybe he did. And therefore, he is certainly disappointed about their behavior, but on the other hand, the deal is a deal. The deal is a deal. He had ample option to say, I don't want to do it. What would happen in the aftermath? Okay, he would have to suffer the consequences. True. And precisely because of the consequences taken in consideration, therefore he's willing to go through with this deal, and therefore the deal is a deal. And there's no question of the rest here. No question of the rest. No question of points. Now, consequently, let's come to the argument of, you don't like it? Anybody don't like it? No? Very good, I must say, you're a very good student. Okay. But even, let's go further.
How do you answer people who say that secular courts are more moral than Beis Din?
I can't hear you.
How do you answer if somebody says the secular court is more moral than Beis Din?
Because Beis Din is not moral. See, that's lawyers. Lawyers don't even smile. They don't even smile. Beis Din is not moral. Again, let me make Chavos Hashir. Let me go back. I'm just explaining to you that Choshen Mishpat is not a moral code. It's a legal code. Does it mean that people come to Beis Din when they sign arbitration? Okay? That they shouldn't be asked to sign for Pshara? Absolutely yes. But there are some rabbis, right, who are very staunch puppet rabbis, and they say, I will tell my client not to sign it in Bishop Pshara. No! We want to have Din. Right? What he's doing, he's shooting himself in the feet, in his foot, and into his head, both together. And the reason is very simple, because he doesn't understand the basic principle how Beis Din functions, how halacha functions. He thinks Beis Din is going to rule, if they don't have the leeway of Pshara, that Beis Din is going to take in consideration the moral argument. Beis Din cannot take in consideration moral arguments, because Beis Din only can take in consideration the legal arguments. And the legal arguments are a simple mechanism. And therefore, anybody who advises his congregant, or anybody, his friend, whoever it should be, don't sign on the story the ruling for Pshara. Only Din. Besides, the Beis Din shouldn't do it anyways. Because who knows if they know to pass on Din, right? But, I mean, even Rav Shimon Bar Yochai didn't know. But it doesn't matter. Even if, let's say for argument, they would know. It's the most major disservice to do to his client. Clear?
Not make me happy, but it's clear.
why not make you happy? It should make you happy that now you know you should tell your congregant, sign on pshara.
Make you happy. Well, I can tell them that you'd be more, you get a better moral result than the base.
Not more, whatever you should do. But again, don't mix moral values with legal values. Let me put it this way.
So why is it a moral value if somebody enforces you to do something from a legal perspective, he didn't do it? It's not a moral situation.
What is legal?
He didn't do it.
But he did do it. Certainly did. He was in his full mental capacity. He got a counter value for what he did. At the end of the story. It's a mechanism. A storm is a storm. Is it? Isn't it? Is a storm a storm or not? Is a storm considering any kind of moral values? No. It's a law of nature, right? This is the law of nature here. It's completely irrelevant to the surrounding factors. That's the ABC of Choshen Mishpat. People need to remember that, you know. The people forget it constantly, yes.
Where does it cross the line into robbery?
Robbery would mean if I tell you, you just give me your thing here. Just give it to me, otherwise I'm going to kill you. That's robbery.
So how's that different than the other?
No. If the fellow comes in here, right, and says, I want to kill you, and you say, take all my assets, don't kill me. That's it.
Take all my asses, or otherwise
I'm going to
throw you in the street.
If the Nazi comes in and says, whoever the room, right, comes in and says, I want to kill you. Says, Yankel, don't kill me, take my asses. That's the Krikon. The deal is the deal. If he said, just sign it over now, right, and I didn't want to sign it over, so that is not so simple. Then it might be a case already when the action itself was not voluntary. That might be. It's also not so simple. This is not so simple, but then we could maybe say that.
So if he says, give me the wallet or I'll shoot, that's
robbery. This is robbery. Okay. This is robbery. Because he's going to shoot you anyways. He's going to shoot you. And being he's going to shoot you, so you have the choice. Either you give him the wallet, or he's going to shoot you, but he's going to get the wallet anyways. In the case of Sri Kirkon, not necessarily so, but that's a different discussion how far it goes. I just want to explain to you that the argument of duress, right, is not so simple. If I was able to save myself from the duress situation, good enough. Good enough, yes.
What is the concept of the Siras
Magah? Okay, very good. Very good. Now, he says, there's a concept which is called Siras Magah, which means the person knowing that this kind of violence could happen, already in advance, signs a document where he said anything I'm going to do later should be invalidated. That could happen. Under conditions, it could happen, certainly. That's true. So, Mr. Maidu would help. In the case of Mr. Friedman, right, so there might be an argument to say that it's not so simple, but in the case of Mr. Friedman, if he knows in advance what client and daughter are going to do, he wants already to prepare himself for that, and therefore calls another people and says, I'm going to sign on the will, but let it be known to you that I never meant it, right? Am I doing that just because I want to save my situation? Then it might be, it's fine. It's also not so simple, because the case of the Gemara, when the Gemara discusses unse de nafshe, means if a person, for example, on his own goes and sells, because he needs money, goes and sells. But it wasn't put. He wasn't put under duress. In other words, he was not threatened. The action did not root in the person who created the duress. I created the duress on my own. Which means, for example, I need money. Being that I need money, consequently, I go now and I'm selling. Before I do the sale, I give notice, prior notice, that I only sold it because I need money. Okay, we are saying, sorry. Many people sell assets because they need cash. So therefore, whatever you said in the beginning, the rest was created on your own, right? Whereas, in a situation where the duress was created by an outside factor, an outside trigger, this is a kind of oinus where I, before that, say, I didn't want to sell, and therefore whatever I did at that time was only on the conditions of oinus, and therefore, we are saying there was no gemiras daat, there was no complete willingness and readiness and commitment to save. So how
does one do that? How would Mr. Friedman in this situation effectively do that in front of the Aidim?
Yes, it doesn't have to be. Yes, it will. There's a different situation. He might do it for Aidim, even some say even before, and separate Aidim, doesn't have to be for two Aidim in once. There are all kinds of halachas concerning that, that's true, right? So that he could do, yes. Okay, now, yes. I don't hear you. To leave Yov to buy. Right, so the halacha is that we don't say to leave Yov. You cannot, there's no to leave Yov. Right, yeah. But that's a different discussion, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about giving up assets, we're not talking about buying assets.
He gave assets.
To leave means to give up assets.
Right.
To leave Yov means.
No.
I don't know what you mean by giving you matona, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know what you meant.
So, in this case, you give matona.
I see, I understand. Okay. Matona, one second. Matona means that you don't get anything in return. Here, if this person, in the case of Mr. Friedman, gets better treatment by his children, this is the compensation. This is the compensation. And in fact, one second. And in fact, there's another argument here. The person writing a will, not really giving up his assets in his lifetime, he's only giving up the ownership of his assets after lifetime. So therefore, in principle, he didn't give up anything. You understand? He gave up what we could call the Tovis HaNor, which means the benefit of distributing his assets to this another person. But ownership, per se, he didn't give up at all.
But he's doing it in action. He's getting the services afterwards.
No. When you write a will, whatever that should be, right? Usually the person retains ownership until he deceases. So therefore, he is the owner of it. What?
He can change it again if he wants.
I don't hear you.
He can go later on, he can go to some other lawyer.
He can borrow him.
Yeah. If Mr. Klein lets him go.
Well, he goes to shop.
Yeah. Okay, I understand that. We have done all of this.
You do it in shield, in a hot house.
I didn't hear that one. Okay. Fine.
Is it binding even if it's an Isra of Havaras Nachla? He can leave even Dallas Luke and nothing? Is it still binding?
No, they took him. Mr. Klein was very religious. He left Abu. Yeah.
He didn't.
Yeah.
Ask
Mr. Weiss. Mr. Weiss, did he leave Abu Zuhrim? Yes. He says he left.
Let's say
he did. He even consulted Rabbi Marvel how much it is. So it's perfectly fine. Okay. Let me just continue about. Let me tell a story of undue influence. Undue influence was dealt in Bezdin with, and I will tell you two cases where it came up, not in the context of will, but the context of a divorce agreement. In both situations, so here you see there's a borderline between undue influence and between duress. Because duress means straightforward, straight out. The person, everybody involved here understands there's duress. The one to threaten, the boss to threaten by, or threatened with, is clear. So we have here the people aligned clearly and we know who is what. Undue influence is much more vague, you know, that's what it is. Therefore, yes, it's correct when it comes to court. So then there will be quite a bit of discussion if there was undue influence or not. It's quite vague. The under influence is a cousin maybe, right? The stepson of duress. That's what under influence is. I took over the person's mind. That's what I did. Gurney Das. Gurney Das in the literal translation of the word, right? So that's what under influence is. Question is the analogous such a concept of under influence? So as long as we said in the beginning, he's not in within the definition of a passy, as long as he's not a person who we would say is a real idiot, who doesn't know what's happening to him, the fact that I convinced him that the rationale now should be that he should give over all his assets to me, it doesn't mean therefore that his rationale, generally speaking, is not right. So I convinced him. I'm a good salesman. So what? All of us under the impression of this rather PR. Whatever is politically correct is only a question of PR, nothing else. That's what it is. What we've been bombarded with constantly, we accept it for correct and right. And what we bombard with the other way around, with time we're going to accept it the other way around. That's what it is. Similarly here too. Now it's not on a political level, it's not selling products on a commercial level, it is simply in a situation of a will or anything of this sort. Similarly also, when we're talking about the two cases which were quite similar of a divorce agreement, the argument was here undue influence. In Hebrew, there's a term for that. It's called Hashpa'a Bilti Hogenet. Hashpa'a Bilti Hogenet. That's what it's called in Hebrew. Hashpa'a means influence. Bilti Hogenet. Unfair. Unfair. So they don't call it oinus. They don't call it duress. But it's very close to it. So what was? If the person was obligated, felt compelled to give up, to give a get, because, to give up assets in order that the wife should agree to accept the get. The reverse situation which many people complain about. Right? And he did it. So he said, eventually he wanted to argue and say it was undue influence. He didn't say duress, he said undue influence. And exactly those terms were used here. Hashpa'a bilti hogenet, undue influence. In those two cases, two different cases, there were two major poskim who passed on this case, on those cases. One was Rav Herzog. I guess some of you heard about Rav Herzog. Right? Rav Herzog? Okay, what was it? Goyen Adir. Major Talmud Chacham. So, in a tshuva from Rav Hedra Adaya, who was another major Talmud Chacham, who mentioned it seems to be this argument, I couldn't find it, but it seems to be that in his tshuva somewhere, he argued this kind of argument, said Rav Herzog doesn't exist. Hashpa'a bilti hogenet, undue influence doesn't exist in halacha. As long as the person wasn't a complete passive, wasn't really an idiot, nothing there. And if it's an oinus, okay, so then it depends on the criteria you mentioned earlier. If the person knew it's worthwhile to give up his assets in order that the wife should be willing to receive the get, let it be so. On a similar note also, Rav Waldenberg in a tshuva of his, right, exactly the same case, what came up when he was ready a dying, Rav Waldenberg in Tzitz Eliezer, writes the same thing. If you want to find it out, where Rav Herzog is, it's in the Psokim Moksovim Choshim Mishpot Siman Ein Gimel. That you could find. In the middle. It's Mamish in the middle over there. And the Tzitz Eliezer is in Chelek Design Siman Nun Gimel. Right. That's where you could find it. So in those two situations, we see clearly that the concept of duress or undue influence is completely different than we see generally. For this very reason, because undue influence does not necessarily turn him into a passive, an idiot. I would agree in the case that you mentioned earlier about the person who was already not able to recognize clearly who are his children and so on and so forth. Yes, there's no question about it, because of the passive argument. But not because of the argument about influence, or not because of the argument of duress. It has nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. For the simple reason, because, as I said just earlier, because oinus, to the contrary, it might be a factor to validate, not to invalidate. Undue influence might be altogether thrown out because it's not undue influence. Nothing of this sort. If I may just add something very simple concerning this comparative law situation. It's quite clear that it depends which kind of instance you go to. If you go to an instance that sees moral values in one way, and to another instance that sees moral values in a different way, you might end up with completely different conclusions. This is not when you talk in halacha. In halacha, both, regardless of what the moral values might be, halacha will still dictate the same conclusion. And therefore I feel this is another argument, like I just said earlier. You see, when it comes to a situation when both submitted to Beis Din, and I think I spoke about it in one of the CDs earlier, I think it's absolutely obligatory that everybody should advise, my dear Rabbi Oppenheimer, you should advise your clients, you should advise your congregants, that they should not necessarily agree only on din. They should agree to do it even according to Pshara. Because if not according to Pshara, you're going to end up with this mess when they are saying later on, Rabbi Sabet and Paskin completely irrational. Doesn't pass completely incorrect. And they're wrong. And they're right. They're wrong because Halacha is correct. And they're right because, yes, moral consideration should be taken into account. Any questions?